Hello, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's Wednesday, the 27th of May, 2009. I'm your host, Herewood Fenton, and tonight we have a show dedicated to discussion with Josh Jackson, my regular guest, Josh Jackson, and my slightly less regular guest, John Bursell. And we will be mulling over a variety of stories, starting with some local Australian content and then moving to the bigger picture of some issues in relation to questions about 9/11 and the 9/11 truth movement. Now, we're going to begin tonight with three Australian stories, which are quite, each one quite important from my point of view. And I'd just like to first of all welcome my guests, John and Josh, to the show.
G'day, Herewood. How are you, mate? Another great week.
I am extremely well. Flying by the seat of our pants tonight, trying to get everything organised at the last minute on a smell of an oily rag budget as we have here, trying to hold down a day job as well. Ain't easy, pal. Okay. Josh, welcome. John Bursell, welcome to the show.
Hello, Herewood and Joshua. How are you going?
G'day, mate.
Okay, we're going to start off with three Australian stories. And John, we don't often have you on to discuss our local content issues, but I'm sure you can provide some insight, and I know you've got a lot to say on many topics. So I'd like you to just feel free to be part of the discussion. I'll just kick off with the first story that we're going to be addressing tonight, which was actually on the news this morning, and it was on the ABC News this morning, and it's been picked up by a few news sites. And this is to do with the election trigger being essentially called by the government's policy in insisting on going ahead with the emissions trading scheme. And I'll just read you a quick synopsis. This is from watoday.com.au. Emissions trading standoff presses election trigger. The Rudd government emissions trading scheme is headed for defeat as a result of a Senate standoff, handing Labor a trigger for an early double dissolution election. The scheme is set to be voted down by the Senate next month, despite the opposition leader Malcolm Turnbull announcing yesterday the coalition wanted to delay a vote until early next year. Now, why is this important? Okay. To me, this is an extremely important development. We've been sort of following this. We've all been following it. And I think, John, even you yourself said to me a few days ago, well, it looks like they're backing down on the whole climate change issue. It's not an issue anymore. I don't think that's true. I think that the government is very keen to make this a threshold issue, to push them into a new election, to consolidate their power. Now, as to whether they succeed or not, I don't know, but it must be treated very seriously. They are treating it seriously, and we have to treat it seriously. And what I just want to say in terms of my opinion about the emissions trading scheme, about the whole plan that the government has in store for us with whether it's a straight-out carbon tax or a cap-and-trade system, it is a tax on the poor. It is basically the elite, business elite, globalist elite consolidating their power and now insisting that the government take more from us, basically rape and pillage more from the average person in our society. And I can confirm that the story that I heard today on the news was that, and this was on ABC News, okay, Australian business is set to lose $12 billion if the scheme does not go ahead. That is exactly what they said. Now, when they say Australian business, they don't mean the guy who runs the corner shop. They don't mean any kind of local small business. They mean mega big business. They mean, you know, News Limited, Microsoft, BHP, any massive company operating in Australia that have all set up these cushy little tax-deductible trade, you know, deals where they'll get all this money for nothing. That's exactly what they're insisting upon. I'm outraged by it.
And the funny thing is, if you talk to the atypical green about it and you say, well, actually, do you know the oil companies are actually for, you know, greenhouse gas, pushing this whole myth and pushing that the answer is a global carbon tax, because it is a it's basically free money for them. I mean, they basically, the taxpayers then pay subsidies to them, and they make huge amounts of profits, you know, trading their amounts of shares. Well, not their shares, but their share in carbon.
Yeah, and look, they've all set up these little tax dodge partnerships with like some dodgy operation in India that they say is like earning them carbon credits. And they all ran off and did this a couple of years ago. And it's all nonsense. It's all a scam. Okay, I mean, it's very clear whether you think the information about CO2 induced global warming is true or not. What they are doing is intending to rob us of, you know, some money out of our weekly salary. Okay,
but it goes further than that. It's not just robbing of money. It's not just taking of money and further taxation. It is an infrastructure that is being set up of a global taxational system, a global policing system to police the taxation of the money, of the revenue, and a global system of tariffs and blocks if countries don't abide by this new sort of system. And not only that, so you think, okay, it's not only money, it's actually control. So farmers can't, you know, I can't just move out to the country and have a cow, because I'll have to pay for the, because it's not just carbon, it's also methanes and all sorts of gases. So if I have a cow, all of a sudden I can't have that cow without paying X amount of dollars per year for that cow. And look, folks, honestly, it's not too much of a stretch to say, well, that heads to children and people as well. Every time you have a child, that's, you know, 1,000. And in fact, there's been already pretty prominent scientists out of Australia saying that, we ought to set up a proper scheme where because humans breathe and fart, and so we've got to tax them. So for your first child can be free, but the second child will be $1,000 up front plus $200 a year in you know, carbon credit costs.
You're exactly correct. I mean, it's part of a web. It's kind of a net that they're throwing over us, just like you throw a net over a wild animal to capture it. The net involves pinning us down, holding us down in a variety of different ways. John, are you there, John? Have we lost John Bursell? Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Now, look, I'll just, John, I don't know how much of you missed of the previous chat, but I was actually just about to bring you into the discussion when I discovered you disappeared.
You were talking about, you know, the problem with the possible double dissolution election due to the rejection of the coalition of the current trading scheme for
CO2,
yes. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. Now, look, I know that you've been, you know, you've kind of like evolved from being someone who's kind of on the fence about climate change. You know, a year or two ago, you still gave it a certain amount of credibility, but you've sort of moved more towards the camp of being a skeptic now. Would that be fair to say?
It's fair to say. I mean, I'm still a member of the Greens, but I put a disclaimer whenever I say that now that I don't support their policy on CO2. A lot of Greens don't support it. The way that it's developed, you know, from this greenhouse argument, which, you know, I think I'm satisfied that it's flawed. The argument's flawed. You know, there is a very slight chance, possibly, that the greenhouse effect due to, you know, man's occupation of the earth is causing some change. But, you know, from a historical point of view and from a point of view of what we've seen in the past, it's really insignificant. So it's, you know, it's a storm in a teacup, really, the whole thing.
I mean, look, as I often say, that the way global warming or you know, greenhouse-induced anthropogenic global warming caused by CO2 is described is heavily oversimplified. And there's a lot of implied assumptions in the theory that goes behind what they're now trying to implement as a very bureaucratic system of taxing us. Okay, but I mean, the theory behind it is also, you know, messy. I mean, you've got at least three different strands to it. You've got the claim that yes, temperature changes are over and above natural variation. You've got to prove that. The second claim is
not proved,
that it is caused specifically by man-made greenhouse gases. You've got to prove that, number two.
Not proved, yeah.
Number three, you've got to prove that it's bad. Because, you know, if it's not bad, then we don't really have to worry about it, okay? And you know, there's a lot of people who think it's actually maybe even good, okay? Getting a little warmer.
Well, from a historical point of view, that's probably true. But due to, you know, occupation of low-lying coastal lands, possibly it wouldn't be good for a lot of people. But anyway, it's, you know, really the whole thing is, you know, the argument now, if you get into a real deep argument, you know, which we did recently with someone that reports to believe in the CO2-driven climate warming argument, you'll find that, one, most of them don't even understand the science. Two, that they resort to saying it's the, you know, they don't necessarily know this term, but this is what they're on about, the precautionary principle.
Yes.
The fact that, you know, we're running out of energy and we need to conserve it and we need to, you know, control our footprint on the earth. And it's, you know, it's all really the basis of the environmental movement.
Yeah, well, instead of, you know, let's just tax the, tax the hell out of everyone instead of tapping.
And they actually agree with you that that's wrong, like, in the end, but they're sort of stuck. They're stuck in this dogma now that once, like, I said this in a Greens meeting about 18 months ago, I said, look, the corporations have taken over the global warming argument. Now, it's really not an issue for you anymore because you're not in government and the corporations have taken control of the issue and it's, you know, really we should move on to more important issues. Because, you know, it's out of their hands. The Greens don't really have any control over this issue anymore at all. You know, really, the people that have got control of the issue are, you know, the Al Gores and the corporates that are going to make a fortune out of trading this new commodity. They're going to trade life on the open market, you know?
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, the major globalist and like the sort of charismatic heads of, you know, corporations that we know, people like Ted Turner, people like Bill Gates, people like Rupert Murdoch, Richard Branson, you know, these are figureheads, and I don't even think that these people are the seat of power. I think they're way below where actual most of the power lives. But they all, a few years ago, collectively, all jumped on to the greenhouse CO2 Al Gore, you know, scenario wholeheartedly. They just jumped in, boots and all.
They all had an epiphany overnight, did they, Harold?
All of them. Like, each one of them. It's incredible. Wow. I did some research recently. It's incredible.
The coincidences that go on today are amazing, aren't they?
It is. And I mean, and these people, you know, they live in a different world to us. I mean, they're like as far removed from us in our daily life as we are from, like, an ant. I mean, literally.
Look, they are the zookeepers, and we are the zoo animals, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, they never have to catch public transport, folks. I mean, you know, they, to them, it's like, oh, if I don't use my private jet and I take a commercial flight, I'm doing some marvelous thing for the environment, you know. I mean, that's exactly, you know, they are such incredibly privileged, you know, king-like, pharaoh-like individuals, that for them to have any kind of pronouncement about what is good for all of us is just sort of utterly ludicrous. But, of course, they have the power. You know, sitting at the top of these massive corporations, they can influence things incredibly.
They can. Well, let's just go back to something that because we didn't really get through the points about global warming. Let's just establish a couple of simple facts for the listeners so they sort of have an understanding of what the precautionary principle is. Now, the precautionary principle said if all the things that, say, for instance, the CO2 global warming people are advocating were true, obviously, you know, with the predictions that they've made with their models that really, you know, don't work anyway, are saying that we might have a sea level rise and it might cause this and cause that, and we could have increased weather problems with, you know, bigger hurricanes, warmer oceans, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, the precautionary principle says if that is possible, well, you know, to a reasonable level, say it's 1 in 10 or it's 10% likely that might happen, then we should be careful. Now, I sort of don't disagree with that necessarily. If something's going to be catastrophic that could, you know, destroy our way of life on the earth and lead to a runaway greenhouse, which has never happened before in history, but if, say, for instance, the science was credible enough that I could believe it was possible, then the precautionary principle might come into effect. But you would not tax CO2, would you? Because it's the smallest, one of the smallest portions of greenhouse gas, and it's also it contributes to life. It's like not a bad gas; it's a good gas. So,
can I just interject here? Can I just interject? Yeah. But please continue. But I just want to say one point. I agree with the precautionary principle,
yeah,
and I think Josh does
that
as well. But I apply I apply the precautionary principle to tyranny.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good point.
And
this is what we've got to try to get through to people like the Greens.
Indeed, we start giving bureaucrats more power. Watch out, buddy. You know, it's never ends well. Sorry,
that's right. And you know, like people on the left steer away that have jumped onto the global warming argument because they feel really good about it because it's an issue that they think, you know, is saving the world and it's going to reduce energy and it's because people do feel guilty about what we're doing to the earth. But the problem is that we're not addressing those issues. We're addressing something else that's not a problem with the earth. And that's where it becomes very confusing for a lot of people, I suppose.
That's right.
They're really very confused about the whole thing. And, you know, the basic facts are CO2 is not a dangerous gas. It's life itself. You know, it's one of the fundamentals of existence of human organisms and plant organisms and all the rest of it. It's not something that is a problem for the environment. The link between it and global warming is, for the first time in history, they're trying to say that CO2 is leading temperature change, which is an idea that really has no basis, you know, except for it's a concept or a theory that they try to link to an increase in CO2 simply because two graphs really are following each other, if you put the right figures in, that is, that you can make it appear as if that's happening right at this moment in time, a very small section of time. But we know that for the last 5 years or so, it hasn't been happening at all. So even the basis of their whole theory, which is CO2 is driving temperature, is not happening at the moment. And when it was happening, it was only most likely just an anomaly in the system. And historically speaking, we know that, 500 to 1,000 years lag normally when the CO2 comes up after the temperature increases because of the ability of the sea to sequestrate or to hold the CO2 in it because of the temperature rise. Basic science. The basic science says that it's unlikely, it's unproven, it's untested, and it really is flawed, you know, and that's really the case, you know.
The point you made was made very clearly in the great global warming swindle, and it has never been refuted. Since it came up in that film, and that film was massively attacked
by critics,
but they could not refute that point. They made a lot of, underhanded attacks on that film on a lot of small points, but its major points could not be refuted. Correct, Josh?
Absolutely, yeah. They attacked other things like his past and the filmmaker and his personal life and what other films he's made instead of actually looking at the points he makes.
There are a couple of scientists in the film that were their quotes were used and they got grumpy about it. Okay, they got grumpy about it, but they couldn't deny that what they said was used. You know, it wasn't totally like, oh, just snippets quoted out of context. It's just that some of these scientists have said things that go against what they themselves think. You know, well, so be it. You know what I mean? Like their own research, you know, and they themselves say, well, I believe in global warming, but hang on, your own research says this, and I'm just quoting from it. That's what he said. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's fair. I can't see what the problem is. That would come under fair use, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, but I mean, in the media, what we've seen is that these you know, very honourable concepts of fair use and good intent go out the window because you get this sneering, just viciousness that we saw with the television debate that was done with Tony Jones and all that on ABC, and we just saw this incredible sneering kind of like aggressiveness, this contemptuous attitude that really. They don't play fair. I mean,
no. Well, it comes down to cognitive dissonance again. You know,
it does come down to that. I suppose.
Yeah,
Josh,
I mean, a lot of people have invested a lot of time.
If you believe in the global warming argument, say for instance, you really do believe it, then you know people like us questioning it are risking your whole existence on this planet. So that's a pretty confronting thing. And that's really led to divide a lot of people, and it's just another one of the things that. Needs to be addressed. It's the manner that we go about these discussions, and it's the manner that we deal with people, and the way our governments operate, and the way all these secret groups and all these committees that can't be questioned and all these debates that aren't having. It's just it's so dogma driven. It's so status quo now. Like, you know, the corporates decide something and we've all just got to go along with it because it's all too hard to question it. And you know, I don't know. It's what's going wrong with the human race. It's driving me insane. Well, look, real debate.
We need to have, and that's why this show exists, and that's why we're going to keep doing this. And look, I just want to get it back to the question at hand, which is double dissolution trigger now, because the government is so intent on going ahead with this, they don't even care. They'll throw caution to the four winds. They're going to hope they're going to consolidate their power by doing this. They're going to make it a double dissolution trigger. Now,
Explain to the folks at home.
Yeah.
John, you're probably best at explaining what a double dissolution is.
Well, I mean, a double dissolution is just when the government can't pass a bill, but it's normally to do with supply. So it's normally when the government can't get money. That's normally what the double dissolution trigger is. Really, to call an early election in this situation, it's not really, from my knowledge, I'm not an expert on it, but it's really the government just calling it an early election because it's not getting its way. That's really what it is in this case. It's not a question of supply. It's not a question they can't pay the public servants or they can't pay the military. It's a question of the fact that they're trying to get a scheme in that they see as vital to the survival of us or something. They're going to make some, you know, reason up. Really, basically, it's because they're very popular at the moment and they will consolidate their power and it will give them the ability to do more than they're doing now and to do it in a more aggressive manner, I suppose.
Yeah.
But would you agree with that, Harold, that a double dissolution previously has always been about money supply?
I think it hasn't happened very often. I think Bob Hawke had one. I'm just trying to remember back. In this case,
it's really just calling an early election. It's not a double dissolution. I don't think because double dissolution is when it's got to do with the money supply. The government becomes unable to do anything because it can't get any money.
Yeah, because the Senate is blocking. In this case, the Senate. You see, they've got the numbers in Parliament, but they don't have the numbers in the Senate.
Mm.
So the Senate will block it, and.
Yep.
When the Senate blocks the passing of a bill, I think it doesn't have to be just, you know, a supply bill. That's what happened to Gough Whitlam, of course, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, and Gough Whitlam, you know, you might say should have called a double dissolution election, but he knew he would have lost it and he didn't want to do it.
Yeah, the Governor General came in and just called an election instead.
Yeah, which made it even worse in the end for him. But I think if the Senate blocks a bill that the government wants to pass, I think they can call a, but don't quote me on that because I'm really not that well.
Yeah, the terminology, I'm going to have to look it up now. I'm quite interested to find out exactly what it's all about. But basically, the government can turn an election at any time within its time in government, the 3 years. So,
I've just read it here in the story.
Oh, good.
A double dissolution can only take place if a bill is rejected twice by the Senate 3 months apart.
So that's double not allowing it to pass, right?
A double dissolution. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether it's money or not.
Doesn't matter. Any bill.
Okay.
Any bill rejected twice.
Put up twice and it fails and they can call an election.
It's that easy. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that'd be easy for them to do. They could put up a bill that no one likes and they could call a new election, couldn't they?
Yeah.
I wonder when it is that they can call an election within their normal term. It might be only in the last year or something, I think.
Possibly.
Yeah. But anyway, I'll do some research on that. It's quite interesting. We should know. We don't know a lot about our political system, do we? It's funny,
Well, we're all too busy. We're all just, you know, like.
We are.
I mean. We struggle to just, you know, get home and switch on television and watch Big Brother.
Yeah, I mean, I spent the last day writing this article debunking these no plane, you know, nutcases.
Yeah, look, we're going to get into that.
The stuff we have to do. You know,
We're going to get into some of the 9/11 questions a little bit later in the show. I've got a few, two more Australian stories I want to cover, quite important. So, look, I mean, we're just gnawing here at the edges of these massive issues, but there's possibly going to be an election trigger. The ETS scheme is outrageous, unworkable, and an offence. And that's, you know, I think a reasonable view, not an extreme view at all. It's just a reasonable view based on the information. So
can I just say one last thing about an emissions trading scheme, folks? And I've said it before on the show, but when you set up a market for a new commodity, when you set up a market for carbon, basically, you're guaranteeing that carbon is going to be around for a long time to come. You're not guaranteeing that it'll go away at all, because once you've got a market, you need it to be there for it to be a market. And a lot of people have billions and billions invested into these stocks because that's what they have. They have a stock in carbon, you know, so-called carbon pollution, if you believe carbon is a pollution. And so by setting up a trading scheme, if you do believe that carbon is causing global warming and you haven't done your research and you still believe that, then honestly, carbon trading is only a tyrannical measure to basically control you, A, and B, it basically puts in place a system that allows carbon never to disappear out of, you know, industry or anything else, because you need it to have a marketplace.
It's a tax on everything, basically,
So look,
but the point I was making to you on the phone that you alluded to, Harold, was about the fact that I think that a lot of these political groups, parties, etc., see the writing on the wall. You know, if the temperatures continue to drop and more people, you know, obviously most of the voters inside the Liberal and National parties don't agree with the CO2-driven climate change argument, and a lot of the people inside the Labor Party don't agree with it either. It's probably approaching, you know, it's probably getting up, you know, around the halfway mark now, and people are sceptical of it. So
yeah, but it's
I think they're hedging their bets with what they're trying to do. Obviously, the original system they were going to sign up to was much, much greater than what this one is. It's really a token gesture. But what you're saying and what Josh is saying is once we're in there, we're in there.
Yeah, once the tyranny is allowed to be written
to
into
start,
law.
Yeah. It exists and it'll exist forever then, basically.
Yeah, then what happens is the ones who are the ones with bad intent basically are able to just run the show then, you know. And of course, most people don't want it. Most people in Nazi Germany didn't want Hitler to have, you know, the supreme power of a Führer. But, you know, these things, once they're written into law, it's very hard to roll them back. It's really hard
to roll
them back.
But you must agree they have moved a long way away from their original suggestion of, you know, approaching like 50% reduction by, what was it, 2050 or something, or 2040? Like, I mean, there was these massive reductions I were talking about originally, and now it's only around 5%. Is that correct?
Well, actually, I don't think that's clear-cut either, because recently there was the conference in Copenhagen, and a lot of what's developing now has come as a result of Copenhagen. And I'm pretty sure Kevin Rudd was there, okay?
Yeah.
And a lot of pressure was put on our government to go harder. You know, you're not, no, 5%, no, you got to go the
floor. Oh, yeah, I know that, but we didn't, did we? So it just makes me think that Rudd's hedging his bet.
I'm not sure that...
The other thing the listeners have got to remember is that the politicians are in a tricky situation. A lot of them, like you said, John, don't actually believe this sort of crap. But they're under this pressure that if they even murmur the words that they're not a devout believer
in 9/11 or global warming. It sounds very similar, doesn't it?
Oh, it's very similar. but if they even murmur the words, the media, and mainly hedged by the ABC, will cut them down so hard.
Oh yeah.
That their political future's over. And the thing is, though, folks, is that most people I talk to that have done a little bit of research. You know, and even the greenies that I've known that have gone, right, I'm going to turn off the part of my brain that's just been slammed for the last, you know, 15 years about this greenhouse effect, and actually put a little bit of thought and process and research the other side, have gone, wow. And all the farmers I know don't believe it because they've seen the cycles up and down and they've heard the stories and they've, you know, got the records. And so this whole... A lot of voters, a lot of the constituency actually don't believe it. So what I would recommend everyone to do is write a letter to your representative saying, hey, I'm glad you're not supporting this bill, or please pull out from the carbon trading. I think it's a load of bull, because every 10 letter represents, what, 100 views or something. So if, you know, 10 people, that's 1,000 people in their constituency. And now then these politicians will start to feel a bit more, you know, oh, a little bit more sort of, you know, not as frightened of coming out, of and saying,
put,
well,
put the pressure on, do what I've done at a Greens meeting and say, look, I think the premise of CO2 driven climate change is incorrect, and I don't support it, and I'm for energy conservation for the right reasons, not for the wrong reasons.
Absolutely, I'm against pollution, man. I'm a green, I love it. I love to have a clean earth.
Well, you're a bushwalker like me, aren't you, Josh? I love bushwalking. I love the bush.
Oh, mate.
I spent my whole life in the Royal National Park growing up. You know, I love the environment and I'll do everything I can to protect it. But I'm not going to stop CO2 going into the air over something that's not based in science. It's just based in hype. That would just be the wrong thing to do. We must stand up for truth. You know, there's nothing wrong with truth. So what if they've got to change what they're going to do? So what if some corporations lose some money? Who cares?
Exactly.
Let's get the truth.
Well, yeah. Exactly. Let's get the truth. Look, we've done a hell of a job on that topic. Let's move on. I'm just going to hit us with a quick break. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Okay, we're back, finally. The system is under control. I'm at the controls. Josh Jackson is coming to us via satellite. And John Bursell is coming to us from his submarine. And we are trying to resolve some major issues relating to the future of humanity here tonight. Apologies for all my cock-ups. But it is an amazing thing, technology, I tell you. Software, all the buttons, all the little windows and buttons you can magically drag around on a screen to have things do for you what you want them to do.
All based on the universal language of mathematics. Beautiful stuff.
It is.
So what's the next thing on the agenda here?
Okay. Always like to focus on Australian content. Okay. So I've got two more Australian stories for you tonight. The second one is really one of my own concoction. And I haven't even had time to write this up, but I have in my hot little hands, and I'm just going to reach over here and grab it. The primary subject matter, the prima facie case that I can call against the Daily Telegraph for lying to the Australian public, and I'm just going to read to you an article that was published in the Daily Telegraph on Saturday, May 23, 2009. Massive, huge, bold headline, swine flu epidemic, thousands at risk as government raises virus alert. Now, I just, glanced across this. I was in a cafe and I picked it up, as you do. And I thought, oh boy, that's a pretty, alarmist kind of story. But it gets worse. I mean, this has a just straight out lie, a bald-faced lie in it. Australia faces a full-scale swine flu epidemic as the deadly virus starts to spread rapidly, with 12 new cases reported in just days. The federal government last night raised its epidemic alert from delay to containment following the first confirmation the H1N1 virus is passing between humans within Australia. There are now 13 confirmed cases in the country, 2 in New South Wales. Experts predicted the number could rise into the thousands and become an epidemic during the winter. Fears the virus is moving quickly came as 2 schools in Adelaide and 1 in Victoria were forced to shut as students become ill. Since Tuesday, 12 people have been confirmed to have the virus. Now wait for it, here comes the big lie. Responsible for almost 1,000 overseas deaths. I just had to turn the page because that was on page 2. Okay.
1,000 deaths. Is that what it actually says?
Well, it says almost. Okay. Now, how many people... This was published on Saturday. Now, I've got the data that is actually the current data from the World Health Organization, and I have it all ready here. So, any guesses? John, what do you reckon? What do you guess? How far off do you think they were?
The real death toll?
Yeah, I mean, and I'm talking here not about people speculating on fringe media shows. I'm talking about the World Health Organization's official number.
Well, it's probably around 100 or so, isn't it?
Yeah, you're in the right ballpark there. It's less than that. Let me just get it up here.
And most of them had pulmonary problems or had other issues. And
oh, yeah. Not, I mean, they,
really,
they were,
you know, the healthy, all, yeah. Well people in, you know, like, you know, adult people aren't dying of this at all, are they?
Look, I think 95% of them are from Mexico.
There's hardly any running water. There's like...
Well, there's a lot of, you know, obviously different living, you know, different conditions. It's hard to... Mm-hmm. There's obviously something funny going on that is clustered so much in Mexico, which, you know, raises questions. But look, the point here is there's a lot of things we can talk about, a lot of debates, a lot of questions.
Yeah,
the point is, they said 1,000. The official number here is 86, okay?
86, yeah.
Now,
so 86 people, they say 1,000. I mean...
Almost 1,000.
Do you know, folks, how many people die in the States alone? In America alone of the flu each year is 36,000 people die of the normal flu. Every year. I mean, that source is from, what is that, CDC? I don't know exactly.
From the World Health Organization in United Nations. The CDC doesn't actually have, I went to their page as well, they only have US deaths. They don't seem to count, they don't do the global. So World Health Organization does the whole planet.
Yeah. Mm.
Now, look, this is just part of my continuing drive. I almost said crusade, but I don't like using that word. Okay, basically, my continuing campaign, okay, to alert everyone to the fact that we are being massively lied to. Because they've said that. Hundreds of thousands of people have read that. This is creating mass hysteria. And it's not an accident. I do not buy the argument, oh, it was just a mistake. They have
and there was
careful...
no retraction printed, was there?
No. Well, yeah, well, maybe there was, but I don't know about it. And I'm sure most of the people who read the newspaper don't know about the retraction either, if there is one. I doubt there is one. I mean, look, we covered the other story last week from the complete lie on 9MSN about internet censorship in France. You know, I submitted that to MediaWatch. I got no reply. I mean, it's exhausting trying to keep up with this. It's outrageous. And we as a society, and you know what people often say when you talk about, you know, newspapers like the Daily Telegraph, they just give you a smug little smile and they go, oh, well, you know, it's a silly, you know, it's one of those, you know, broadsheets, or what do they call it? You know, tabloids. Yeah, it's just a tabloid. Ha, ha, ha. And you see, this is self-deprecating. People have become self-deprecating. They've lost their self-respect to know that this is, I mean, this organization, and I don't want to go too hard on them, okay, but, I mean, they've totally monopolized print media in Australia. They basically own it all. And the only reason they've been able to do that is complete complacency, complete subject, abject, you know, lie down and kick me attitude of every group, every organization, including the average person, that's allowed that to happen. We only have ourselves to blame for this. Okay? Sorry if that sounds a bit harsh, but we let it happen, folks. We let murder...
Well, the good news is, folks, that the newspapers are almost dead, you know. They're breathing. They're on their deathbed. And you know, stuff like this is just another nail in the coffin as far as I'm concerned. You know, the real answers are all online. You know, there's a lot of crap on there as well, but there's so obviously there is in the broadsheets. Now, you know, what does this do? This causes fear in people, but it also is total disinformation. Yeah. So people run around going, oh, no, I've got to have the jabs. I've got to have the jabs. No one ever questions what the jabs are in the mainstream. They never talk about the bad side effects, which we talked about on this show, of Tamiflu and others. None of that is ever talked about. It's always this sort of hype and destructive behavior. There's not even any sort of, there's just this sort of massive headlines. Not even any, like, because on this show, we ask people to prepare for a pandemic. I think it's important to. I think it's important to have storable food on you. You know, even if it's just a month's worth of some cans and some drinking water and some toilet paper and some things. Be prepared. Be like a good Cub Scout. But don't be like driven by fear. You know, and you know, the other thing is, sorry to butt in, Herod, but yeah, just to finish what I'm saying here, right now, the latest headline is New South Wales to blame if outbreak happens throughout Australia for letting people off a boat. Now, listen to what that means. That means New South Wales government is to blame for letting people off a boat. So what that's actually saying is the government has to put martial law into place and be in control of everything, not to be blamed.
I know. They were being accused
our mainstream...
On the news today, they were being accused of not restricting domestic air travel. There was why doesn't the government restrict domestic air travel?
What is the plan here? Like, if we stall the outbreak of swine flu or this new virus, which, you know, we get a virus every year through Australia in the winter. That's normal. So we're restricting the swine flu because it's a moderately bad flu, and it's basically killing less than normal flu does. And, you know, so what is the actual reason that we're worried about the spreading of this flu?
No,
it's got
no
a scary name.
Yeah, scary name. H1N1.
But is that, wasn't there some science behind the fact that maybe if it gets to a stage where there's a lot of people with it, it might mutate to a more dangerous form? Is that the theory there? I know there's some science behind why they're panicking, but I'm not sure exactly what it is.
Look, I've been listening to stories on this constantly. I've been listening to the BBC.
I'm saying that sarcastically. I've read into it quite a lot.
Look, I've heard nothing along the lines of what you're saying, which would make sense. What you're saying sounds logical, but I have heard nothing.
Yeah, there were people that were saying things like this, but I haven't seen it backed up with any, you know, evidence.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been listening to all the BBC coverage of this. Not once have I heard it said that, yes, we have to nip this in the bud because it could mutate into a killer virus. No one's even suggesting that.
You're not going to nip it in the bud. You can't stop this thing, obviously.
Well, yeah, of course not. I mean, the best thing to do with an epidemic is just let it run through and let it finish. You know, let it run through.
Because it's going to be mutating overseas while we're not having it here this flu season. And next flu season, it could be a lot worse. And, I don't really know. It's obviously a complex thing. But whatever it is, this panic's not justified from what I can see.
Well, I mean, I tell you, there's two strains, it's two kind of messages I've been hearing. Is one is that it's a very mild flu. It's basically harmless. It's less of a problem than your average flu. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of what I've heard too. Yeah.
But the other is this constant alarmist statements that come directly from the mass media, directly from Reuters, directly from the media outlets. And what I've learned from my study of the way the world works in the last few years is that there are policies that are injected into the media that have nothing to do with what the experts or the government even says. But inevitably, over time, what happens is the experts and the government end up echoing what is injected into the media. This is complete control. They have a brainwashing function within our society. And I know that may sound extreme, okay? And I don't want to get into tinfoil hat, you know, scenarios here, because I don't want to go down the path of extreme paranoia. But what I can tell you is that I've been watching it, and I can see that the media injects policy direction thoughts into their coverage, which then force their way into popular discourse.
Yeah, well said.
And we have to fight against this. We have to stand up and say, okay, we need a free press, okay? We need an independent free press. We can't just have Reuters and Associated Press at like a top of a pyramid feeding into all the news organizations the select group of stories that they want to magnify. We have to stop that somehow.
Yeah, But folks, it's important not to say, yes, we need laws. We need laws to stop this.
We need everyone listening to this show to start a blog of their own. Every single person listening to this show tonight, start your own blog, okay? That's an order, okay?
I like that idea of what you're saying about the way the media comes out. It's sort of like if, say, for instance, there's a constant drumbeat, you know, like eventually you find yourself walking to that beat, don't you? And that's sort of what you're saying. It's because it's so relentless, and they do tend to, you know, it does seem that we've got a very few, well, we've got five or six corporations now that pretty much, you know, send most of the news out, the big story news anyway. They're controlling that. We've seen that time and time again. And obviously, we've got this cross-pollination or whatever you want to call it, or, you know, we've got directors on, you know, these companies, like, you know, a lot of directors will be directors on three or four corporations. One will be in the military, one will be in the media, one will, in the medical field. And we have this insidious, sort of situation now where, yeah, these things are decided with a very small amount of people, obviously, within these media organisations, and where their money's coming from, and where they're, who actually owns them, who are the major shareholders, is obviously another influence as well. But there definitely is this, it's like with the war, you know, the media we get from the war. I mean, it's well known now that if you, you know, go to Baghdad, report on a story, you just go and hang out at the Baghdad Hilton, and the CIA just deliver your, or the Department of Defense just deliver the story, and then you just rewrite it the way that you see fit, taking the basic facts from what they present. There's no real news. So journalism's like dead. It's like, it's really bad.
Yeah, that's it pretty is. Much the truth.
And the best way to fight this, if it is a fight, is just to literally, read other stuff. Turn off your TV. Don't support them.
In order to have a blog, and I just had another thought. Now, I think everyone out there should pick a subject. We were just saying before, you can't know everything and do everything. We're all just trying to survive.
Yeah.
But, I've picked 9/11 as my subject to learn about and learn the ins and outs of it and keep pushing on that topic. And other people are looking, like Hera was trying to look at the broader picture and look at the way that the new...
Looks like we might have lost John. Are you still there, Josh?
Yes, but, I agree with what...
I think we just lost John. He just dropped out. sorry about that, folks. We'll just have a quick pause and we'll get him back. While we're waiting to get John back on the line, I'm just going to play you a song by Bob Dylan.
Well, I sing you a song, it ain't very long, about an old man, he never done wrong. How he died, nobody can say, they found him dead in the street one day. Well, a crowd gathered one fine morn at the man whose clothes and shoes were torn. There on the sidewalk he did lay, they stopped and stared and they went their way. Well, a policeman come and he looked around. Get up, old man, or I'm taking you down. He jabbed him once with his bully club. The old man then rolled off the curb. Well, he jabbed him again and loudly said, call the wagon, this man is dead. The wagon come, they loaded him in. I never saw the man again. Well, I'm singing my song, it ain't very long, about an old man who never done wrong. How he died, nobody could say, they found him dead in the street one day.
Okay, we're back. John is back. I hope you like that song. I love that song. It's one of the early songs that that Bob Dylan wrote that never actually got onto any of the albums. Anyway, it's worth listening to a couple of times because it's very stark. And
what's it called?
It's called Man in the Street. It's just like a little picture of life and death and the sort of meaninglessness of the way human beings are treated in a modern city. You know, a man dies and he's never done wrong, an old man who never done wrong, you know, and he just dies, and then a policeman comes along and wants to arrest him and finds he's dead, so he gets dragged away, you know. Just story like that, you know, nothing more than that. But
that's terrible.
That's the way people are treated in this machine-like, impersonal civilization that we've created for ourselves in the modern society.
No, I choose not to live like that. I choose to help my fellow man and woman.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it's either you're in that mindset or you're not. You know, like, and there's always been poets and artists and people who are trying to bring us out, you know, make us feel compassion.
They are, exactly.
You know, make us
so that
connect.
That little rant I was on, Harrowood, can I just
yeah, please continue.
What I was thinking was, and obviously someone in whoever it was that's got control of this phone line didn't like it.
Yeah.
But if like you said, you get your own blog, okay, you pick an issue. It might be, you know, it might be vaccines, it might be GM food, it might be 9/11, whatever it is. Pick something that's got some evidence. Seriously, we're not getting told the truth about in the community, and start researching it. Write what your thoughts are on it, and start correlating stories and build a new picture, the one that we should be getting told, you know, a view of the real issues. And at the same time, you know, talk to people about it. You know, start doing what communities used to do. You know, talk about issues with your friends, and don't listen to what you're being told by five or six corporations, you know, like in the news, that are all following similar agendas, whatever, you know, they might be at the time, whether it's the swine flu thing or whatever dogma it is that they're pushing. And, you know, and just start becoming your own sort of journalist, because they're really just doing such a bad job. Like, you know, reading some of the stuff that you see that these so-called journalists, I mean, actually my father calls them reporters. He doesn't think there's actually any journalists left, and I have to tend to agree with him. They're really just not doing the job anymore. They're just regurgitating the same old thing, you know. It's disgusting.
Yeah, well, they get a Reuters feed, or they get some sort of feed off the internet, and they just read it out. Or they copy and paste. And I mean, you watch Media Watch, and it's just every time. They just grab some press release that's on the wire and they just copy and paste it.
Well,
they don't even bother
changing
it. That's
the hack journalist. But there's another category, which we're going to get onto shortly, which is the psychologically shrewd one that crafts. And these people are quite skilled. They're not just... I mean, I can't really say they're lazy. They're putting a lot of effort into what they do. They must be paid a lot. That's all I can say. But they're actually propagandists. These are people who've dedicated their lives. They've sold out. Okay, they're completely professional propagandists, and they will weave and construct a construct of reality for you. And there are many of those. They tend to be at a different level, or I think a lot of them, there's a lot of evidence that these people have been injected into media organizations to reflect government positions. I mean, we know this has been happening, okay? It's been happening for decades. And I mean, a lot of people on the show might have heard of Operation Mockingbird, you know, which is well-known CIA infiltration of the media. There are other organizations that I know about where government has created agents. There was an organization called the EIS, which was set up by the Centers for Disease Control, okay? And they also have their own people that they've basically groomed and prepared, and they're actually got, you know, a second job. It's like part of their job is to be a journalist, part of their job is to report back to the CDC, because this medical industrial complex is incredibly powerful. It's an incredible fusion of industry, you know, pharmaceutical industry, government, and, you know, military as well, because it becomes indistinguishable from military when we start talk of like a bio warfare, you know. And so these organizations have always worked carefully with the military. And we often hear that one of these outbreaks of a virus came out of a lab. Well, what labs do they come from? Well, you know, they generally come from biowarfare labs, because the governments have been working on these germs for decades. But do you want to know my personal opinion on all of that? I think it's a complete load of baloney. I think it's complete... I think it's rubbish, okay?
Well,
I don't think there are any killer viruses that can kill a million people. I do not believe they exist. And I've got my reasons for saying that. Okay. Partly is this, right? Despite all the accidents and all of the things that have been developed, that none of these has ever led to a major disaster. You know, Ebola, they say that's the most terrible disease, the most incredible disease. Why has Ebola never had an epidemic outside of the areas where it is endemic in Africa? There's certain parts of Africa where Ebola is endemic. It's a horrific disease, granted, you know, hemorrhaging, liquefying of organs, right? But it's endemic to a certain population which has certain health issues associated with it. And this is always the way it is with disease epidemics. They affect people who all have similar conditions. The last major, you know, massive death toll we had from an epidemic in the world was the Spanish flu.
1918.
Which, again, affected people because we had a very, very different society back then. And we had conditions affecting people which we don't have now. Massive overcrowding. Nutritional problems from huge food shortages from the First World War. People worked much harder. You had a whole lot of conditions which do not apply. Okay.
Well, you had the whole basis of the way that developed was the fact that they did all that vaccination with really not knowing what they were doing with all the troops, put them on the ships, closed quarters, very poor conditions, and then it mutated while, you know, they were on board the ship, and, you know, they got to the battlefield and they were gassed and all these other things happened. You had chemical toxins coming into the mix, and somehow we ended up with this mutation that caused this flu that was terrible, you know. So there was a lot of factors there, but like you say, we just don't have that situation anymore today.
Yeah, and look, I mean, I may be wrong. I'm just saying, as far as I know now, and from all the evidence that we've got, to be overly concerned about a massive disease epidemic that's going to kill millions of people is a complete waste of time, and I'm totally confident in saying that. Of course, it might happen, but we might be hit by an asteroid too, okay? Let's worry about that, because that's very real, okay? I mean, there are extreme events which could occur. I don't doubt that. But they seem so incredibly unlikely that I'm a little more concerned about tyranny. I'm a little more concerned about the actual all the wars which we are deliberately inflicting upon humanity, and the degradation,
the growth in government, yeah.
The dehumanization that we're being subjected to.
Mm. Oh, look, just look at Guantanamo Bay. I mean, it's just such a falsehood. It's just such a despair. Here's the government. Grab some bunch of people, just a group of random people off, you know, a theater of war and elsewhere, sticks them in a cage, tortures them, and says, oh, they're terrorists or they're baddies, when there's no real way of telling whether they're baddies or goodies. There's no real way of telling if they're terrorists. They have got no due process. They've got no, you know, jury by their, you know, they've got no cross-examination. They've got
they've
no
got
habeas
the
corpus.
Hang on, but wait a minute, they've got the... torture instruments, Josh. That's what they used in medieval times, and they were regarded in medieval times as very valuable tools.
It's just basically a gulag.
You know, the medieval Inquisition had their special tools that they used to prove that you were a witch, okay? And they could prove it, you know, and they could dunk you in the water, and if you sank and drowned, that proved that you were a witch, okay? And if you didn't drown, if you swam and floated, then that proved you were a witch. Sorry, I got it wrong. If you drowned and couldn't float, that proved that you were not a witch, but you were dead anyway because you drowned. If you floated or swam, that proved that you were rich, and then they would burn you at the stake.
Reminds me of that great book, Catch-22. If you're crazy, then obviously you'll fly. The mission's at great danger. If people know Catch-22, it's a story about a squadron of pilots and crew that are flying these bombers on these relentless missions, and they're all slowly getting killed. But the argument is that, you know, if you're sane and you demand not to fly because, you know, by feigning insanity, then, you know, it just goes around and around in circles. It's exactly what you're saying with this scenario. You know, that basically one thing feeds, it's that circular logic, isn't it? You know, that's so useful to tyrants, I suppose.
Yeah, the old Catch-22. I mean, you know, that was just put into, you know,
if you're insane, you fly, and if you're not insane, you don't fly. But because you're not insane, then you have to fly, you know, so, because you're not insane. Yeah, you know, it's just the same sort of thing. It's just that's the way the world is, and it's just been getting worse.
And it's put into popular culture, and, you know, it's...
Well, how important is this swine flu if the fact that, you know, Andrew Johns had a gangbang, you know, a couple of years ago, and that took, what, it was taking 7 or 8 pages of the newspaper, and swine flu just dropped right off the radar there for, what, like a week?
Oh, yeah, and we had the King's Cross Bogan, the girl who, you know, the chick, chick, boom girl, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
they're just distractions, aren't they? Like, and if they've got a better distraction than swine flu, they'll just run that for a few days or a week or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, a story can be manufactured out of nothing these days, and suddenly it becomes a international sensation. I mean, the chick chick boom girl is now. I don't know if you know, are familiar with the story, Josh. Probably
yes,
a little bit too immature. Okay, good.
Oh, it's a Channel 9 thing.
Yeah, well, of course it was a Channel 9 thing. It would have been all over the shop there, wouldn't it? Well, look, you know, let's not waste our time with it because it's too trivial. I'm sure our listeners who are from Australia would probably know what we're talking about. If you want to Google it, Google a chick chick boom girl. It looks like her story might have been scripted. I don't know. She may have just made it up on the spot, but either way, it was manufactured into a massive story by the way it was, pushed forwards. And of course, oh, it's incredible. It's a huge story. Wow. You know, and then because it's a huge story, everyone goes and reads the story. But look, there's another story I want to cover tonight in our Australian section, this comes back to the issues of people being the average person, the average citizen in our supposed alleged democracy, our alleged free country, is being treated increasingly with we are being preyed upon. We are being treated as a combination of being like a herd animal or a host to parasites who are feeding on us. And just, you know, I mean, the analogy, I guess, is like the Matrix, the film The Matrix, you know, where they're sucking our life energy in every possible way they can to feed themselves. And this is what's actually happening with big business, with the advertising industry and big business selling to us all the time, trying to market to us psychologically, trying to get hooks into our brain at the same time as they are trying to pull back on our freedoms and at the same time as making us guilty about putting, you know, the wrong plastic bottle in the wrong bin or some horrendous, you know, crime like that, you know, or just breathing being a crime, you know, because that's carbon dioxide. But the other side of the coin of that, which I just want to cover briefly in this story, is the way we are being fed on and totally abused and humiliated by the advertising industry. Now, I've got a clip to play here. It's called the Bedroom Police ad. Now, I don't know if... because I don't watch television, but I did pick up this story from the newspapers. And are you familiar with the Bedroom Police ad, either of my guests?
No.
No, okay. I don't watch much television these days either,
okay.
And especially not commercial television. So,
well, okay, it's an ad put out by an organisation called the Advanced Medical Institute, which is a totally bogus name. Okay, it's just
it's read
a commercial.
That, yeah,
it's a
money making scheme.
It's a cheap, sleazy, you know. But they have television ads that are very slick, so they've got a lot of money behind them. It's no joke. Okay,
and they're the big billboard campaigns too about, you know.
Yeah.
Perform better in bed and all those things.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And it's all about totally humiliating men. It's all about it's creating this dichotomy between men and women where the man is put in this position of being like some pathetic little loser who can't get it up. You know, and the woman is often seen in these ads sort of sneering at the man because he can't do it. And these, like, this is not even considered pornography. It's incredibly pornographic. You know, there was one, I've watched a few of them today to just catch up on this whole subject matter. And I mean, it's incredibly pornographic in a really psychologically manipulative way. I mean, they don't have, like, you don't get to see someone having sex, but you get to see all of the things that go with it, including people in bed. You just don't actually see the actual physical act. But in every other way, it's total pornography. Now, children can easily see these ads. I mean, I don't know what time they show them. But, I mean, basically the fact is that they are shown on television and a child could easily be watching it. And these ads are totally humiliating and degrading and dehumanizing. Most of them are dehumanizing towards men. And I think there is a deliberate strategy here, about creating this dichotomy between men and women and demasculinizing men, basically emasculating the male to make him feel more and more guilty and more totally subject and powerless. Because, like, as we've seen, that there is this sort of general program to splinter and fragment society, which gives them more power. And a lot of the focus of control these days is on women, and a vast number of women now who have children have become single mothers. And, you know, if you think the single mother is the perfect organ, the perfect subject of control from the state, she's totally dependent on the state for her livelihood. And the state can program her with whatever it wants, and then that goes through her into her children. And this, what they're doing with these premature ejaculation and impotence ads, I think is they're driving a wedge between men and women. It is really horrific. Now, I've only seen a few of them. I have watched TV a couple of times in the past few years, and like in even those few times I've watched it, those ads have come up, and I've always been absolutely horrified by them. I've been in shops where they have the radio on, and there'll be some booming voice saying, "Do you have a problem getting an erection?" And you're going, "Well, I just wanted to buy something, you know, I'm just here to buy a newspaper." And there's this, you know, male voice saying, you know, like, "God, hello." You know,
I can't really speak to that. I sort of know what you're getting at, but it's just not really hitting home with me. But one thing that was hitting home with me was that ad campaign about, you know, kids playing up in the car and, you know, you're small or whatever, you know, the woman with a little pinky doing the small thing to men that, you know, show off in their car, that ad campaign the RTA was running.
Yeah,
that was,
that's right.
That, you know, that sort of, I thought, was a little bit offensive maybe to people that don't have a big one, you know, but I don't, you know, they tend to sexualize a lot of things these days, and I think that's the thing that rings home with me, Harold, is that the sexualization of life as we know it is just over the top, you know.
Well, and this is this is about sex itself. Like, this particular subject is about sex. It's not like sexualizing some other thing. It's like they're actually invading right into our personal lives. And I mean, look, I don't really want to get into this subject either. I don't want to start talking about it. But I mean, if you don't want to have sex on a particular night, or, you know, like, it's okay. It's, you know, you don't have to perform. Like, treating people that they have to perform, that's total slavery.
I get that concept.
And then making a joke of it, or in this case of this particular ad, which to me is not the worst of them, and I've watched a few of them, they're all equally disgusting. But this one, they actually have the police come in while the man is, you know, trying to make love to his wife.
Oh, okay.
We'll play it now, but I'll just read you the article that was in the Sydney Morning Herald today. Yep. Bedroom police ad ruled offensive to men. The Advanced Medical Institute has been forced to pull its latest television advertisement on the grounds it ridicules and shows contempt for men suffering from premature ejaculation. The Bedroom Police ad features a former country practice character, Sergeant Frank Gilroy. You see, they're even playing on shows that are on television. They're getting a character out of a television show to be on an ad. I mean, do you get it? Do you see what they're doing?
Yeah.
Okay. Played by actor Brian Wenzel, breaking into a couple's bedroom and threatening to issue a speeding ticket. The man in bed is told he will be let off with a warning if he contacts the Institute to help with his premature problems. Can you believe this? Okay.
It's just shocking. You know, the crazy thing is some women want it fast so they can get it over and done with.
I know. Yeah. The world is full of different types of people. And again, I don't want to get into that sort of conversation where we talk about that. But the point is, you're totally right, Josh. And it's totally wrong and outrageous and insidious and tyrannical for them to be telling us with police. Oh, my God. God, can anyone feel the outrage that I'm feeling now?
Yeah, no, I mean, I've talked to people and they're like, some women say, you know, I just can't be bothered with doing it because he takes so long and I just can't be bothered. I'd rather just get it over and done with, you know.
The point is, it's a personal, private matter.
The thing that concerns me is that it's attacking vulnerability. You know, advertisers are pushing vulnerability. Now, if I was the government, which I'm not, you know, I've got this belief that, it should be, you know, you shouldn't be allowed to advertise or manipulate people based on vice or vulnerability. And, you know, obviously that's probably the main issue we hear, is that they're picking on a sensitive subject that would really hurt someone's feelings, and then they're telling them that it can all be good if they spend money on the product offering.
But advertising
at the highest level, you can't get much more than that, you know.
But advertising is all about that. I mean, that's what advertising is. You know, look at the hair ads. You know, oh, I was so much happier when I had hair. And then they'll talk about, you know, how great it is to have hair. And, you know, I mean, most men above the age of 30 have got hair loss. You know, I mean, it's just normal. It's a normal part of getting older, just like wrinkles, everything else. But they'll make you feel totally inadequate because you're losing your hair. Now, like, I mean, I'm the opposite of you, John. I would definitely not ask government to pass laws to stop that. I just say to the consumer, don't support these pricks, you know, honestly. Just
got to say, the consumer at this point has to turn off their television set. And this is what I really do say to people: do turn off your television set, because you've ultimately got to do that, folks. I mean, you can't just continue to come home and watch television for a few hours every night and not be you will be psychologically affected by this type of stuff.
Yeah,
I don't think
a good thing to do also is to contact Channel 9 or Channel 10 or Channel 7, whoever you're watching, and say, I'm now making a concerted effort to turn off my television because the advertising you guys are showing are below a standard that I like. And, you know, you're making me feel inadequate or whatever, or, you know, or it's over-sexualizing things or whatever. And just say that's the reason. Because if you just turn off the television out of protest and never tell anyone, then, well, you know, it's a good thing for you because you just actually...
Well, I'm actually saying it for their health. Like, what you're saying is probably valid too, but I'm just saying this is dangerous. This is as dangerous as, you know, smoking two packs of cigarettes a day is dangerous, okay? I do believe that watching this stuff is dangerous. I actually do. I don't think you can just say, oh, I'm immune to it. I'll just put a, you know, I'll block it out. I don't think you can. Because if you're watching it, think about it. Why do you even watch it in the first place? Because you want to, okay? And because you want to, and it's been shown that when people watch television, they put themselves into an alpha state. It's a hypnotic state.
Yeah.
When you're in a hypnotic state, you are suggestible.
Yeah.
So if you continue to do that and you find you're wanting to turn the television on, that's an addiction. That's like a low-level addiction. It's exactly like when you want to light up a cigarette. I've got to turn the TV on. You're making yourself vulnerable. Now, if it was just showing you good quality documentaries or good quality dramas and, you know, things that hadn't been made with some deliberate malintent, not a problem. But it's all got malintent in it. And we open our brains up. When we sit down at the end of the day, we've been working all day, we're tired, we want to just relax. We open our brain up and then they feed it into us.
Mm.
I don't know.
Absolutely.
I don't know what to say. I mean, it's very...
No, it's kind of frightening. Like if you go for a walk at nighttime down your street and every house has got this flickering glow, this sort of magical flickering glow coming out the window. Every house, and if you walk through the city, the apartment blocks, every apartment block, and it's kind of like this spell that goes over the city and feeds everyone their propaganda, you know. It really is so beneficial to turn off the television. You know, you start to engage with your children again. You start to engage with your parents. You start to engage with your friends. You start to engage with your books. You start to maybe go do a painting class, or you do other things.
There are so many things you can do. There are so many things you can do to broaden your... even your concept of enjoyment, you know? Your concept of enjoyment doesn't just have to be that hypnotic state of sitting watching something fed to you. It doesn't have to be like that.
No, and the trouble is, you know, a lot of people have invested very heavily into their entertainment systems, so their so-called entertainment systems. So, you know, they've spent $5,000-$6,000 on the best audio, the 1080p TV screens, the PS3 Blu-ray, and all that. So there's no way
But you know, some of these people can't tell the difference from the standard. But anyway, yeah, go on.
No, but you know.
But they've got it.
they've got it, so they're not going to turn it off.
No, you know? That's right. They're going to enjoy it, and they're going to watch their three games of football on Saturday night and not go and see live entertainment and actually have a real good time and support community and live music and everything else. Like, we know that the TV is just everywhere, and yeah, it's insidious. But anyway, we're going to move on, Harold.
Yeah, look, I'm going to play this. Clip now, and then we're going
to
move on.
Yeah, so I'd like to hear this.
I'm going to play it, so just hold tight.
Oh, no, not before me.
Excuse me, sir, do you realise how fast you were going in this bed?
And who are you?
We're the bedroom police, and we clocked you at 1 minute 30 seconds.
That's pretty quick, I must admit.
Well, this time I'm going to let you off with a warning. If you agree to talk to the doctors at AMI about your premature ejaculation problems, they could really help you. Call AMI now on 1-800-40-40-60 for help with your premature problems.